States are getting ready to make their own rules when it comes to sports betting. And many Illinois lawmakers say it's time to get in on this growing market. Today, we'll talk about whether sports betting would be good for the budget and for pro sports. Plus, last year, fewer than 4% of incoming medical students in Illinois were black men. What's behind that, and what should be done about it? And Governor J.B. Pritzker wants to change our state's income tax so that higher earners pay more. It's going to take a long time to get that done, and it's already looking like a big political fight.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, Illinois could be the first state in the Midwest to legalize sports betting. But is it good for our state's finances and for pro sports? Plus, Governor J.B. Pritzker is making a big bet of his own that he can change the state's constitution in order to repeal Illinois' flat income tax rate. But first, last year, fewer than 4% of incoming medical students here in Illinois were black men. That number can be surprising on the surface, but it could also have more serious health implications for all African-American men. And the path to medicine comes with many obstacles. Some students don't get the support they need beforehand, and even if they do, going to med school is incredibly expensive. What else is behind this trend, and what's being done to address it? Joining me on the line now, I have Stephanie Whiteside, who's been reporting on this issue for Illinois Newsroom. She's also a reporter for WSIU Radio in Carbondale. We also have Dr. Don Arnold with us. He's chief of surgery at Heron Hospital, just outside of Carbondale. Stephanie, Dr. Arnold, thanks for being with us, and welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Arnold, I'd like to start with you. When did you know that you wanted to be a doctor?
You know, for me, it kind of happened in high school. I was very good at science, and I wanted to help people, so I thought being a physician would be a nice blend of the two. I really enjoyed, you know, science, and you see people every day, and you wish that you can do something for them. So I kind of blended those two perspectives and decided to do medicine.
And speaking of high school, when you were asking for recommendation letters and asking to take more advanced classes, what sort of response did you get?
I received pushback from my high school counselor. At the time, I was finishing all my homework early. At the time, I had a very high GPA, and my mother is actually a huge proponent for education. So she used to ask to see my homework because she couldn't believe I was done already, and I would show it to her, and she felt that I wasn't being challenged. So she told me to go to the school and ask to take advanced level courses, which I did, which they declined to let me into. So she had to actually come up to the school and speak with the counselors themselves and demand that I get put into those classes. You know, their reasoning was, well, he has a great GPA. We don't want to ruin that by doing something that's too hard for him. And my mother said, you know, that she would be that determinant, that I wasn't doing any homework, and she wanted me to be challenged because I wasn't doing any homework at home because it was all done before I got there.
Mm. Stephanie.
And I was finally allowed into the classes, and I did fine.
Yeah. Stephanie, Dr. Arnold mentioned not being able to take the classes that he wanted, like advanced physics. From your reporting, is this a common problem?
It's hard to say exactly because, you know, people don't track who asks to be let into an advanced class and just told no. But schools in America are increasingly segregated by race, and often students of color are in schools that are underfunded and may not even have advanced classes. But when they do, students of color make up a much lower percentage. For example, in Illinois, black students make up 17% of the student population, but if you look at AP enrollment, they're only 7.8% of AP students. So there's definitely some disconnect.
Yeah, and Dr. Arnold, it does seem strange that a good student like yourself would be deterred from taking advanced classes. Was it clear to you as to why? Did you think it was because of race?
At the time, no, you know, because being that young, you really don't have an appreciation for people's motivations, you know. But I think all people have an implicit bias for one thing or another, whether it's based on race, whether it's based on sexual orientation, whether it's based on religion. We all bring our biases to when we evaluate a situation, you know, but we all have to be aware that we hold these biases and keep ourselves in check to determine if it's appropriate, you know. But I think the implicit bias was, you know, this African-American kid is not going to do well in this class, so I'm not going to let him in, you know. And that was based off of no data. You know, if you looked at my track record, the odds were that I would do just fine, you know. But I've seen this bias at every single stage of my life, and even currently, you know, it still occurs because people are people and we all have our biases, you know. But I think we need to be aware of those and try not to let that alter how we treat people ultimately.
Sure. And let's fast forward to the med school process, Dr. Arnold.
Yeah.
Certainly finances play a big part in all of this. What financial hurdles did you face along the way?
The main hurdles are, one, paying to apply to medical school. Two, once you're in medical school, you have examinations that you have to take. And at least when I was taking them, I believe they were around $2,000 to take an exam. So at the time, you know, we just didn't have that disposable income to put to a test. So my mother had to not pay some of her bills in order for me to take exams. So as you can imagine, you literally have one shot and everything is riding on that one test, which is a lot of pressure for any person to go through, you know. And then once you're done with paying for these tests, then if you want to interview or go to residencies, you have to pay for the flights to get there and the hotel room and transportation. So it can be a huge economic cost.
Sure. I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation now. Don Patton is a recruiter for the MedPrep program at Southern Illinois University Medicine. MedPrep works toward recruiting more people of color into the health professions in Illinois. Don, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be a part of the show today.
And Don, you've been listening to Dr. Arnold talk about some of the barriers that he had to overcome to be a doctor. Do you find that these are similar to some of the students that you're working with at MedPrep?
Yes, indeed. In my involvement with many of the students that we recruit to MedPrep, many of them come from low-resource communities where their schools may not be up to par educationally with respect to STEM programs. Many of our students come from not generational wealth. Many of their parents are either unemployed or working at low-income jobs. Mm-hmm.
And Don, what does MedPrep do to help young men and women who are trying to work in the health profession? What types of services do you offer?
Yeah, well, as you probably know, we're part of the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, and Southern Illinois School of Medicine has a long track record of commitment to serving the underserved in rural areas and inner city. We have one of the oldest post-bac programs in the nation. And our mission is to increase the number of students of color and disadvantaged students from Central and Southern Illinois and throughout the nation so that someday they may go back, once they come out of medical, dental school, go back to those health profession shortage areas.
Sure. Dr. Arnold, just hearing Don Patton talk about some of the services that MedPrep offers, what would some of those things have been helpful for you as you were applying to medical school?
Absolutely. I actually went to the post-baccalaureate program at the University of Illinois at Chicago, which I believe is very similar to the program that he's referring to. And that program was very key and instrumental to my success in medicine and my success now. Those programs are needed and they're very important because they provide a very important infrastructure that a lot of us don't have when entering into this arena. So I'm very glad that it still exists and it's going on, and I hope that the students are taking full advantage of those programs because they're important.
And Stephanie, what about the students, the current students that you've talked to in your reporting? What are you hearing from them about the help that they could use?
Well, I spoke to, in particular, one student, Jonathan Tice from MedPrep, and, you know, he talked about the challenges that he faced when he was doing his undergraduate work, he had a lot of familial and financial responsibilities outside of school that made it challenging for him. And so he is really grateful to MedPrep for helping him kind of boost his academic resume in hopes of going to med school.
Sure. And Don Patton, back to you. Why is it so important that we have more minorities, more black men in medicine, and that they succeed?
Well, I think the data indicates that if there's a black male or a person of color treating a patient, you get better compliance, and certainly Dr. Arnold can speak to that issue. But in my research, that's one of the prevailing informational point I think is critical, particularly in areas of preventive care. There was a study, I believe, out in Oakland several years ago where they had about 702 black males, and some were able to see only just black males, and some were able to see white and Asian physicians. And the evaluation indicated that the black males liked all of the physicians, but in terms of compliance, they were more compliant in terms of like getting cholesterol screenings and other kind of preventive care.
And Dr. Arnold, yes, the same question to you. Why do you think it's so important that we have more black men in the field of medicine?
Well, I just want to first say that I agree with the statement that was previously made 100%. We know with regards to healthcare, once again, we all have our inherent biases. So the data shows, especially how he mentioned for preventive care with regards to cardiovascular disease and prostate cancer prevention, we know that African-American and white men are treated differently. Once again, I don't think that this is maliciousness. I just think that this is our inherent biases, you know. And I think if you look at how this entire world works, diversity is always a strength. It's never a weakness. When you buy stock, what do people say? Diversify your portfolio. When you look at animals in the environment, the most diverse are the ones that succeed and go on to the next generation. So I think that diversity within medicine is very important. One, to ensure that all people are getting an adequate level of health care, but also to ensure that all people are having an adequate access to that health care. That's another component that's not addressed in our community, because we're underserved. So you may have a black physician there, but it may be one physician to every 100 to 200 or 1,000 patients. You know, that's just not adequate, so we don't have the access. But I think that the data does show, you know, when you have that diversity, that everybody wins and everyone is healthier, and I think that should be the goal.
Very good. Stephanie, and besides programs like MedPrep, which Don Patton has outlined for us here today, what sort of steps are you seeing that are being taken to address this problem?
Well, one of the things that came up in the story is that it's starting to be looked at from an insurance perspective, which I thought was very interesting. I talked to Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois in March this month. It is March already. On the 19th, they're holding a summit. It's not a public summit, but it will be bringing together medical schools and other medical organizations to try and start looking at these pipeline issues and how to solve them, because as we're hearing, this problem starts long before someone actually gets to medical school.
And Dr. Arnold, back to you. What would you tell other young African-American men who are interested in becoming doctors?
What I would tell them, if this is a dream or this is a goal of yours, to hold on to it and to do what you need to do to achieve it. Any person has the ability to do these things. We're not special people. We're not picked from some other universe. You know, we are just people that had a dream, that decided to work hard, and we achieved it. So any person can do that. And I would say to use whatever resources that you have available, whether that's family, whether that's a med prep, whether that's another friend, just really learn to leverage those resources to make yourself the most competitive candidate that you can be. But success is definitely achievable. As I stated in my article, I'm no one special. I wasn't born in this. No one gave it to me, but somehow I was able to make it. So if I can make it through, any person can make it through. And I would also say for them to find out the people that are part of the MedPrep and get their perspective and get a mentor. and have someone to help to navigate through this terrain, because it is different than what most of us experience.
And time for just one more question. Don Patton, back to you. What are some of the most important things that you tell students who are in the med prep program to encourage them, to keep them going, maybe when things do get difficult?
Well, you know, here in the program, I'm a licensed clinical professional counselor, and certainly I work with students around resiliency skills, the ability just to cope with everyday living, you know. Many of our students have income, finance problems. They have personal problems back home. And so I try to work with students to keep them focused, be able to have what I call bounceability, be able to bounce back from minor setbacks, continue to refute that innate critic in terms of I'm not good enough. And so we talk a lot and discuss about the ability to overcome obstacles and utilizing the new study skills that we teach our students here in the program.
That's Don Patton. He's a recruiter for MedPrep at SIU Medicine, a program which works toward increasing the number of minorities in the health professions in Illinois. We also heard from Dr. Don Arnold, chief of surgery at Heron Hospital just outside of Carbondale, and Stephanie Whiteside, a reporter for Illinois Newsroom based at WSIU in Carbondale. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Indian Paintings in From Hand to Hand, Painting and the Animation of History, with an art-inspired performance of Indian classical dance, Thursday at 6:30 p.m. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down a law that banned sports betting in most states. Today, that means that each state has the authority to decide whether or not it wants to make this legal. And Illinois could be on that path soon. In his budget address, Governor J.B. Pritzker said he wants Illinois to get in on this new market before other states get there first. In fact, his own budget assumes that legal sports betting will bring in $200 million for the state. So, is all of this good for the state as a whole? In a minute, we'll hear about how this will affect pro sports. But first, I'm joined by Bob Bruno. Bob is the director of the University of Illinois Labor Education Program. Bob, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'd like to start with just how this would work. I think most people know that there's already a fair amount of sports betting, even if it's not technically legal. So what would change if Illinois were to formally legalize, tax, and regulate this market?
Well, what would change is this very large market that exists would now be subject to a tax on bets that were made. And depending on what that tax rate was, it's estimated that there is about $12 billion that are bet on sports annually. So depending on that tax rate on bets that were made, the state would generate upwards of perhaps conservatively $100 million in state government tax revenue.
And let's talk about those numbers a little bit. The governor put $200 million in his upcoming fiscal year budget. That's the number he says will flow into the state during the next fiscal year. Sounds a little optimistic, considering that this isn't even legal yet.
Well, you know, in terms of how you think about what's possible, we tried to address this in our report, and that was that, there's a lot of gaming that's happening in the state. There's a lot. There are casinos. There's a lot of video gambling going on. And there's lots of entertainment choices for that discretionary dollar. The number that we come up with is more conservative than the governor's because based on the research that we've seen when we looked at gaming in other states, there can be a trade-off effect where money just moves from the casino or from the racetrack or from video gaming over to more sports betting. There can be peaks and valleys in terms of interest in putting down a bet. And then, you know, you have other states that will probably begin to move into this space. And so that trade-off effect might keep down the accelerated growth in revenue. It's still going to be certainly additional dollars that are needed because the market is just so big for sports betting. But depending on what that trade-off is and whether you think this is just all net increase or whether there'll be some shifting of gaming money, you can end up with a different dollar figure.
Sure. I'd also like to bring into the conversation Frank Manzo. He's the policy director of the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. Frank, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
10 states have already legalized sports betting in the past year, Frank. And do we know anything yet about how it's affected them?
Other than the kind of preliminary numbers first couple weeks and Super Bowl weekend, the straight answer is no. We don't know full effects. Kind of going to what Bob has talked about, the net impacts. But we do know that there is a real market out there for sports betting in those states, just as there is here in Illinois, and that bettors have come into the legal, safe, regulated marketplace from the illicit black market.
And Bob, I'm curious, if you have any thoughts about how much Illinois should try to tax sports betting if it becomes legal. What's the right level to do this so that you bring in as much revenue as you can, but yet you're not tamping down the market itself?
Right. Good question. Frank and I, in our report, suggested that if we follow a model that has been used in the United Kingdom, where the tax is at 15%, that amount might be close enough to a sweet spot where you do in fact incentivize people to make the bets legally and generate the revenue, but you don't set the rate so high that people continue to stay off book. But I think the challenge is probably figuring out exactly or how best to estimate that rate. But we're recommending that 15% rate. And there's some additional revenue that's generated or that could be generated through licensing fees, of course, and something also called an integrity fee, which is something that the sports leagues have wanted to impose, and it's not necessarily in that case money that's returned to the state. So, and I don't know, Frank, that we saw much real authoritative data on other percent tax rates on sports betting with the other states.
Yeah, I guess Frank, right? If you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, just having Frank on the call.
Yeah, so and Bob alluded to this. We looked at multiple different frameworks for how sports betting legalization could occur in the state of Illinois, one of which would be the Nevada style, Las Vegas style, that's been around for decades. Now, that tax rate is a much lower tax rate in the range of 6 to 7%. And so the question is, do we want kind of a low tax rate to bring in to reduce the black market as much as possible and basically just have it at the Vegas style rates, or is there a desire to raise additional revenue to help fund treatment programs for gambling addiction, for instance. There is a balance that needs to be set there, but the three key opportunities here are the economic opportunity, growing jobs, the opportunity to shrink the black market and bring folks into a legal and safe and regulated marketplace, and then the third opportunity to generate additional revenue to help solve the state's fiscal problems and invest in the types of infrastructure and programs that substantively grow the state economy.
And Frank, you alluded to this briefly, but what about the possible costs of this? I'm sure some people listening are worried about how this could encourage gambling addiction, for example.
Yeah, our report does not consider the social cost of legalized sports betting, but it is important to note two things. And one is that there already is a large black market out there for sports betting. Quite frankly, people are doing it anyways. So legalizing sports betting, which is an economic activity that's been approved by the U.S. Supreme Court, would bring those bettors into the safe marketplace. The question is how many more new bettors would join. Mm-hmm. We don't know that information, but we know that, again, people are doing it anyway, so the net effect is not likely to be so large that it's going to cause additional problems. That being said, we do suggest that one way this tax revenue could be used would be to help fund treatment programs for gambling and addiction, that funding doesn't exist in the marketplace right now. This would be new funding for those programs, and that would be another potential positive of legalizing sports betting.
And Bob, back to you. We actually got a listener question on the topic. Elizabeth on Facebook asks, I'm curious, gambling is a regressive way to tax as it attracts people at the lower end of the economy. Is this true also for sports betting, or do people at all income levels bet on sports?
That's a great question. And it's certainly the case that there going to casinos, betting in casinos, particularly video gaming, there is a significant regressive effect in that folks lower down on the income ladders are putting more and more of their discretionary dollars at risk. The sports betting market, however, really does seem to be a market that attracts quite a few high rollers, right? High income earners. I don't know of any real precise authoritative breakdown of the income groups that are sports betting, maybe using Vegas as a model. But it has wide appeal across income categories. That's not to underappreciate the potential regressive effect of any gaming system. But I think there's a much higher likelihood that you're going to draw a lot more activity, which will then be contributing to tax revenue from income earners who, quite frankly, could afford to bet and lose much more readily than with people who are earning, well, minimum wage or earning below the median wage in this state. But I don't know that I've seen any real definitive breakdown of who those bettors are when it comes to booking sports bets.
Okay. I think we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. That's Bob Bruno, director of the U of I's Labor Education Program. Frank Menzo has also been with me. He's the policy director for the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about sports betting. It's not technically legal in Illinois yet, but the governor and other lawmakers, including some Republicans, say it's time for the state to cash in on this market in order to help the state's finances. But how would all of this affect the sports themselves? For more on that, I'm joined by WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Cheryl, how do the major sports leagues feel about this, especially the leaders of, say, the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball? Are they in agreement on this topic, or do they have some different views on sports betting?
Well, what they have done, the NBA with the WNBA, the MLB, and the NHL, they have already got deals with MGM. to be part. You know, they've done deals with them, and the NFL has got to deal with Caesars. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get in on it before everything is going to break open, likely. The thing is, what their deals is for sponsorship and in the NFL, you cannot have casinos aligned with them, but it's for sponsorship for future earnings that they're going to get. And what I understood is that the NBA would like to have 1% of it. The NFL, they're looking at possibly getting as much as $2.3 billion worth of from their alignment with Caesars. So there's a lot of money to be made, but specifically how it's going to be done is going to be interesting. Now, I was talking to somebody that is a legal expert who actually is connected with one of the casinos in Indiana, and he says, like, what a team could do, or actually would be the team, would be their venue, would be actually to put in kiosks to have betting actually on site. That has to be determined yet. So there could be money made by these teams. How it's going to happen, it's going to be very interesting how it all plays out.
Have any of Chicago's sports teams said anything about sports betting and how it might affect them?
Well, I think there's a lot of concerns about it, you know, because you got to make sure that there's nothing that's going to be cause rifts. And the interesting thing, this is the 100th anniversary of the 1919 White Sox scandal. Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are concerns. But what here's an interesting thing that the Blackhawks did on their own. Now, I'm not sure it's connected because the betting situation is going to be going on. But for the first time ever, they are telling us, they started at the beginning of training camp, they are telling us the medical conditions of every player that is injured or not playing that day. They're giving us medical reports. I find that very interesting. There's only a few teams in hockey that's doing this. They used to say lower body injury or upper body injury. They're now telling us if it's a concussion, if it's a leg injury. And I've talked to other people in sports media, we tend to think that they're getting in front of it before they're going to be forced to do it.
Mm-hmm. What about the people whose work people would be betting on? What do athletes have to say about sports gambling?
Well, for them, they have to have concerns because, you know, you don't know what people around them will be trying to get information so that they can get an advantage with betting. And I know it's been around for a long time because, you know, the dark money's been there. That's been going on for a while. But the players, from what I understand, too, is like MLB is trying to come up with a policy where all employees cannot gamble. And that will include players, front office people, trainers, everybody. So they have to be concerned that it doesn't seep into their culture.
Let's say you're a sports fan, Cheryl, and you've got no interest whatsoever in putting down money yourself. What are some of the ways that legal sports betting could change your experience as a fan?
I think it makes me more interested, maybe in a specific player or team. This is where the sports fan, you know, this is where an amateur gambler will be able to put money on the Super Bowl and be able to go here in Illinois to put money down and reap the benefits of it. Or, you know, an event, the NCAA tournament would be a huge one where people would be interested in because people have ties to a college or their, you know, either themselves or their family. So that's where the ties are going to be coming in as far as the amateur gambler.
Very good. We'll leave it there, Cheryl, but certainly we'll be discussing sports betting a lot more as the year goes on, I'm sure. Cheryl Ray Stout, WBEZ sports contributor, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
You're welcome, Brian.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Only 8 states in the country have a flat income tax, and Illinois is one of them. No matter how much or how little you make, your income tax rate is 4.95%. Our new governor, J.B. Pritzker, campaigned on changing that income tax rate so that higher earners would pay a higher rate. But our flat tax is written into our state's constitution, which means changing it will take a lot of time, money, and political will. That didn't stop Governor Pritzker from doubling down on this promise as he delivered his first budget address last month.
To fix our state's problems, we need fundamental tax reform. There's no hiding from it. There's no running from it. There's no lying about it. I choose a fair tax system to get us out of this mess. Now, it will take 18 months to get done, but it's worth the wait so that we can save working families hundreds or thousands of dollars per year. A fair tax will change the arc of Illinois' finances forever.
So if this is the next big political debate in Illinois, what should we expect to see in the coming months? Rick Pearson is a political reporter with the Chicago Tribune. John Jackson is the director of the Paul Simon Institute for Public Policy at Southern Illinois University. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Rick, I mentioned the flat tax is written into the state constitution. Let's have a little history lesson. How did that happen in the first place?
Well, if you remember, we really, our income tax here in Illinois is relatively new. It's 50 years that we've had one. Dick Ogilvie stepped into the office of governor and instituted a state income tax, and subsequently you had the 1970 Constitution that authorized and mandated that there be a flat tax. Look at the changes that have occurred in the Illinois economy in the last 50 years. Back then, Illinois was very heavily a manufacturing-based economy. While no specific rates were set in the Constitution, it even mandated that a tax on corporations could only be within a certain ratio of what the individual income tax is. Now, you know, flash forward ahead, the economy has changed, much more service-oriented. The manufacturing base has shifted. The tax was basically aimed, I think, largely to serve corporations as employers and hiring more workers and more workers paying taxes. And so the state's always been heavily dependent on the individual income tax rather than the corporate tax.
Mm. John, right now we're facing a situation where the leaders of the Democratic Party are trying to change the flat tax while many Republicans want to keep it. How have the two parties stood on that flat tax throughout the years?
Well, for starters, it's been extremely popular as an idea. In our last poll, polled at 2/3 favored and only 1/4 opposed. And over the years, I think it's been fairly consistent that Republicans tended to oppose, Democrats tended to favor, and independents tended to favor. But the stability is remarkable. I took a look all the way back to our first polling in 2008, and 2/3 almost exactly, well, 65% approved that year, 66% in 2015. So it's pretty steadily garnered well above a majority and with only about 1/4 opposition.
Now, you're talking about favoring the progressive income tax, correct?
Favoring the progressive income tax, yes.
Okay, great. Rick, we've heard Governor Pritzker saying that he wants to change the income tax system, but because it's in the state constitution, how different will the process be comparing to just changing a law through the state through the General Assembly?
Yeah, this isn't just a vote by the House and Senate with a simple majority and it becomes law. This requires a constitutional amendment. So, one, it takes a 3/5 majority of the House and a 3/5 majority of the Senate to approve a proposed resolution to change the Constitution. If it gets that, then it goes before the voters. The soonest would be November of 2020. And that also requires a 3/5 majority of the voters or a simple majority of those voting in the election. It's not an easy deal. Of course, we have Democratic supermajorities in both the House and Senate. And I think just my reading of it is that the Senate under Senate President John Cullerton is a bit more liberal, and probably that isn't a difficult assignment in the Senate. But in the House, 74 members, it takes 71 to pass a constitutional amendment. That only leaves 3 people, Speaker Madigan, always calculating on ways to try to keep his majority. He just picked up some seats in the Chicago suburbs in the last midterms. Those are important inroads for Democrats in the traditionally Republican-aligned suburbs. There may be some pressures there on some of those new members, as well as the few remaining downstate Democratic members. Maybe pressures there not to support a graduated income tax.
You know, Rick, the governor has pitched this as a long-term solution to Illinois' financial problems and also as just a matter of what he calls fairness. How much do we know about whether this is a good policy idea for the state of Illinois?
Well, certainly everybody is familiar with a graduated rate income tax by virtue of the fact that's the way the federal income tax works. And there is a question involving fairness. Should somebody who earns $15,000 a year pay the same percentage as someone that makes $1.5 million a year? That's the easy play there. The difficulty is two-part. One is that throughout his campaign for governor and even in his budget message, Pritzker has made the graduated rate income tax and revenues from it kind of a panacea for a variety of the state's very deep financial issues, ranging from the huge pension debt the state faces to the fact of skyrocketing property taxes. That the graduated income tax, we can deal with these kinds of issues and change school funding and basically do all of the promises that he made. The problem is that we don't know what the rates are going to be. Mm-hmm. And Democrats have pretty much conceded they're going to have to put out a kind of a specific rate schedule on what people earn and what rates they would pay into this tax in advance of doing anything involving a constitutional amendment.
John, you mentioned that two-thirds of voters would favor changing the flat income tax rate. According to your latest polling, could that change depending on what those rates might be?
Well, they've been very stable for a long time, but I think Rick is right. It's a long way from here to there. And what will happen, of course, is a massive campaign with millions of dollars spent trying to convince the voters this is a bad deal. And those campaigns can have an impact, certainly on referenda items. It's just, I think, important to note that we start with a very stable base that's been about two-thirds favorable. The other point and argument that this might actually have some weight with is that most of the states that have income tax have some sort of graduated income tax. And, of course, the federal government has had that since 1918, I think it was. So we are accustomed to that.
And speaking of money, Rick, over the last few months, there have been two nonprofits that have formed on both sides of this debate. One of them is called Think Big. The other is called Ideas Illinois. What can you tell us about these organizations?
Well, they're two dark money groups. And quite frankly, I think John's right. We're likely to see for the 2020 election, this will be the item. If it gets on the ballot, this will be the biggest spending item. It's not going to be any campaigns for individual office holders. This is going to be the big campaign. Ideas Illinois is led by Greg Bays. He's the recently retired head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. They've been staunchly opposed to trying to impose the graduated rate income tax. And you can tell in the framing, too, in that clip you played of Governor Pritzker, he calls it a fair tax. Well, Bays and his group refer to it as a jobs tax, as something that will drive jobs away. So you've got the jobs tax opponents. Then you have the proponents, which is another dark money group. They don't have to reveal their sources of financing, but it's well established that it's connected to J.B. Pritzker, Think Big. And they're going to be the ones that are going to be kind of the supportive arm here in the campaign moving forward to try to convince the public.
I'm curious, Rick, do you think we'll see Governor Pritzker spend a lot of his own money on this issue?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's certainly what we saw from the gubernatorial campaign. He's not shy about spending his own money to get something that he wants. And this is, you know, let's face it, this is not like an idea that popped out somewhere in the campaign. This was kind of from the get-go, his campaign to try to affect what he calls a tax modernization in Illinois. So I don't think it'd be surprising at all to see him. He's worth, you know, over $3 billion. I wouldn't be surprised to see him perhaps be ultimately the sole funder of this effort.
And John, of course, the main reason we asked you to come on is because of all the polling that the Paul Simon Institute has done on this issue. You mentioned it's been pretty steady. About two-thirds of voters in the state support the idea of a progressive income tax. I'd like to dive a little bit deeper into the polling, if we could. How does this issue track up across political parties?
Well, the Republicans have been less favorable, and in our latest poll, we had 42% favorable and 51% unfavorable by the Republicans. Independents were 57% favorable, 34% opposed for the income tax, the graduated. So there are differences. Independents and Democrats tend to support. Republicans, not by a huge margin, tend to oppose.
I'm curious, does it also vary in different parts of the state regionally?
Yes, absolutely. The differences that you might expect, the city and the collar counties are exactly the same, 71%, 72% in favor. Downstate, while less favorable, they had a 57% favor and 34%, one-third opposed. So it's not a huge loser downstate either, which is a little different from what you might expect automatically given the Republican opposition that I just cited.
Rick, we talked about maybe some of the issues that Speaker Madigan might face in getting this idea through in his caucus. Sounds like Republicans, though, in both chambers are pretty united against this idea.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we already have the House Republicans, all of them, though they are the minority party, all of them signed on to a resolution opposing a graduated rate income tax. Pritzker had kind of framed this, including in his budget message, of wanting to sit down with Democrats as well as Republicans to try to flesh out some idea on prospective income tax rates and income levels. But clearly, in that resolution, the Republicans are showing they don't want to be any part of this. Democrats, obviously, despite their huge majorities, Democrats would like to have some Republican votes for this, if anything, just to be able to have some partisan cover and be able to call this, you know, a bipartisan initiative. But certainly, as what we've seen from the House, that doesn't look like it's going to be the case.
One last question for Rick here. For listeners who don't follow state politics all that closely, what do you think they should keep in mind as they start to see all of these ads come out on this issue?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to the devil's in the details and what are the rates. People tend to vote with their pocketbook dictates. And if people can, you know, there'll be no doubt any variety of online calculators that people can plug their income in and find out where they fare on this. Certainly, you know, you're already hearing about, well, Illinois is losing population, people are moving away, this isn't the time to raise taxes. There's some data that suggests that when higher taxes are imposed or graduated tax are imposed, that doesn't necessarily translate into an increased number of people going to a new destination. But certainly that's going to be one, I think, especially while we don't have any rates established yet, it's going to be certainly, I think, for the opponents, it's going to be a campaign of fear. And that to, if you add up the price tag of all the things that Governor Pritzker and the Democrats want to do, what will that require as far as a tax increase? And how can it not necessarily impact the middle class in a negative way?
Rick Pearson is a political reporter with the Chicago Tribune, and John Jackson is the director of the Paul Simon Institute for Public Policy at Southern Illinois University. Thanks, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by our friends at WFYI in Indianapolis. Our neighbors to the east are debating a hate crimes bill. Indiana is just one of five states without a hate crime law, and the debate over this bill is dividing their Republican governor and their Republican state legislature. Do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty easy to download, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.